Session number 22658, Rule 14.
What would generally be on in the evenings?
Some of the fellows had their, either their girlfriends or with their families that I'm just trying to think of the right words, but girlfriends or girlfriends' friends and things like that, somebody, well, they might have been old school friends or something like that, that get in touch with them, sort of business, and say, well, we can have a party tonight or something of that style. And, it'd be a blind date sort of business. And then I know on occasions I'd be inspected by the family, that being probably a stranger to them, but the person who was responsible for getting the party going would accompany me to the house, and we'd meet the parents and things like that. So you're always sort of scrutinised a bit. They were the sorts of things that you might have a good party that night. Not like the ones they have today, but from there, so you find your way home the best way you could, because transport was pretty difficult in those days, petrol rationing and the like. But
what about dance halls and things like that? I understand that there was
there's quite a lot.
Who
else they help? Oh, I'm not too sure. I didn't get too involved in that, but there would have been in some of the, like the Adelphi Hotel or something, like the dance floor or something like that. But it wouldn't be a the embassy or something like that, unless it was especially arranged a business. It would be more in the private, or in offices, messes, or in places where they could dance. And of course, that was a time of rock and roll and jitterbugging and all that jazz. So there'd be places that you'd have to pay to go in, sort of business. I didn't get involved in any of those. I think I did get away to the country for might have been a week or something like that, on Bridgetown or not. I'm not too sure. I've got some recollection. I went down there. And
were you able to talk to your family at all about your experiences and the Middle East and the desert campaign?
Oh, whatever it'll be, it'll be the best part of it to tell them. Plus the fact that you wouldn't be telling them anything that would make them worry. So I think they'd probably be more worried about what's going to happen next. So that was the situation.
I presume that you knew that this leave was only going to be of a certain length from being given a date that you had to be back.
Yeah.
What did it feel like as the day approached?
Well, I'm not too sure about the 3 weeks that we had, but the other leaves that we did have. You were given 24 days leave or something like that, and you knew that particularly if you had some mates down in the Claremont camp or that looked after the transportation off back to units, they could put you on some sort of duty which would last about two shakes and you'd be out the gate and business and back the next day. So, but I never, all the leaves I had was back on the nominated day and away we went, whereas some of the others out of the unit had come home for some reason or other, and they were strung out for another fortnight or something like that, because you knew somebody that could help you stay a bit longer, and theoretically it was legal what he was why you stayed, and that 3 weeks we were all packed up and went off in the train.
Well, tell us about that particular occasion.
Well, perhaps if we may have been to report back on a certain day, and when you got there, you probably think, well, we might be able to scrounge a bit more, but they said, right, you're on the train tomorrow or the next day, and you better be on it. Or not so much, you'd be back at camp with all your gear, and that was the situation, and then you'd be transported or embarked to the railways, and then you'd be packed in the trains to Kalgoorlie, and well, with that first particular leave, when we arrived at Kalgoorlie or Parkston, I think there's a staging camp or railway junction. So here we arrived there, and it was in broad daylight, and the CO of the train said, there's no leave, the train leaves here at 9 o'clock, and out there is Kalgoorlie, and the train leaves at 9 o'clock. We're gone. That's it. I don't know how we all got into to Kalgoorlie, and of course by 9 o'clock we're Shemozzle.
Can you give us an idea of the degree of a Shemozzle?
Well, you can imagine what happened to the people of Kalgoorlie, because there was a terrific number of people from the Kalgoorlie and surrounding areas that joined the AOF in the early stages, miners and all those sort of types, and well, there's much drinking undertaken, and when they start to round them up to get them home, I think some of them might have come home in wheelbarrows or something like that. But, well, they got them into collect up all their gear and get them into the carriages. Of course, that was the worst thing that happened. The usual old thing is, let's say there's eight people in a carriage or a compartment. Well, there'd be five or six in there, and they'd have their kit bags and everything scattered around, because there wasn't enough room for it to fit a large number of people into it. So they were sleeping in the corridors and things like that when they eventually got underway. But of course, it got sorted out the next morning. But it was a trip of a lifetime, I might add. The rolling stock was in bad repair and condition. The railway lines weren't much better. The engines were just making it. And they had to be so careful about the speed, so it was a slow old trip. And then they had to allow for the trains coming from the east to the west, and you'd be on a bypass, and you might be there for hours and hours and hours. You know, the chaps have been just walking around out in the desert sort of situation.
So what? It can't have been particularly cool at that time of year. So March.
It certainly wasn't. It certainly wasn't.
Was the
and then, of course, being fed is another another thing, and trying to sleep. Though some were fortunate enough to get in, they had cattle trucks, so at least you could lie down, and they had palliasses in there, which you could lie down on, sort of business. But by the time you got from one place to another, you'd be covered in dust and stuff like that. So. That was the situation. That was the first one. I forget how many days it took for us to get to South Australia. And
what was the general feeling amongst the troops being in this situation?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, for those that were moody types and things of that nature, they... I think they became a bit difficult to, as the length of the trip carried on, and the isolation, and being buggerised around. When we got to South Australia, we went to a place called Sandy Creek, I think, somewhere near Gawler. And we were encamped there for a number of days and things like that, which were, you know, you're given leave. But far enough out of town that you couldn't get into Adelaide, which obviously that was the purpose of it. And so from there on, we just moved by train all the way up to the Atherton Tablelands area, which say that was Cairns, and we was all West Australians on that particular train.
So, how would you rate the level of morale at this point?
Oh, I don't think it did much to the morale. They knew they had to do, and you couldn't do much about it. I mean, there were obviously people that never returned. Not that many, but I mean, they would probably be disturbed in one way or other.
In relation to the way you've been treated on board the train, and your sort of respect for command that were sort of treating you this way, and
they're seasoned. Most of them, you know, the officers were seasoned blokes. They've been with them for a couple of years, so you knew you didn't really want to upset them too much. But I mean, they had to do as they're told, and they were able to. Personal under people, and there's no antagonism about the I mean, there might be a few rude words or something, but then you might get some rude words back at you too.
So getting to the Atherton tale then, I mean, what was the situation in regard to what was to happen next for you?
Well, as I mentioned, we were West Australians. And of course we had the longest distance to go. So we, they probably set the plan that all those in the eastern states, we'd get extra leave from by the time we got up to Atherton's Tablelands. So we had short leave while they had longer leaves and things of that nature. Of course, we weren't too happy about that, but once again, there's not much you can do about it. But when we arrived at Kure, we were transported by army vehicles up to there. It was virgin bush. It wasn't true jungle country, but it was thick bush. All it had was bitumised roads, cookhouses, and virtually on a big heaps of tents to be erected. And you know how to erect them? The West Australians. For our friends, our close friends in New South Wales and Victoria. So that so we had to set about organising the camps and all the latrines and things of that nature were put in by contractors and things like that, but it was just absolutely virgin bush and cookhouses and sort of administrative buildings for various batteries and things of that
nature. What did putting up tents actually involve?
Well, they were just a small small tents, 6 fellas, I suppose. They were pretty easy to put up and that.
Did you have to clear the land as well?
Yes, it was. There may have been strips, but then they had to tidy those all up. And the main thing was to make it a suitable camp, and that's what we did.
Obviously, you've been used to the desert situation. How was the jungle training situation different from that?
Yeah, well, that that was well, we didn't do any of that until the whole unit was back in full force, and then the syllabuses and things of that started up, and all sorts of carders and the like were started then, and then there was, you know, you'd be sent away to schools on tropical hygiene and all those sort of things, and apart from the point was that it wasn't open warfare, so the whole thing had to be changed. As far as us with anti-tank work, there wasn't much Japanese tank situation. The only thing that we may have been used for was bunker works and things like that. But we still trained with the guns and of course then we had small arms and things like that. So with what was reinforcements and things, there was, you know, the usual training for the newcomers and things like that. Your gun drill and things like that, everybody had to do that sort of business, whether you'd done it for 5 years or not. So that's that was the types of things that we were involved in.
Did you have any knowledge at all of the Kokoda track and things like that?
Yeah, well, we knew about that, and I'm pretty sure that there were some of them back on leave that had been there, and they were all friends, you know, blokes that we knew before the war and things like
what
that.
What were they telling you about the way the Japanese fought?
Well, they didn't get... Well, I was thinking about the 2nd 16th fellows and that, they were on the Kokoda trial. Then they had the 2nd commandos that were in Timor. Well, we had a number of those that we knew pretty well. And you'd just get pinches of stories and things like that. And we'd be given them some of our escapades and things like that, but you knew about fellas who were wounded or something like that, so you'd hear about those things. You could make your own picture on that.
What was the picture that was forming in your mind in relation to what you might be into in for it, going and fighting the Japanese in the jungle?
Well, first of all, we had to. We did a lot of training in thick bush area around where we were, but the infantry ones were more in the jungle area than where we were. I mean, we had to do all sorts of things. At the time, we thought it was mad. Moving guns at night time, manhandling guns through to put them in certain positions and that. And of course, the 6-pounder was extremely awkward sort of, there's no balance or anything like that on it. I mean, we had fellas, you know, try and make it easier, though they had tired wheels and things like that, pneumatic tires. You'd have fellas on the barrel of the gun trying to keep some sort of balance, and they're going over rocks and all sorts of things like that. It's a wonder, you know, someone weren't killed with those sort of capers, but we just had to do it. That drag ropes used to hook onto the axles, and then you'd pull them like a donkey. Then you'd get the loafers, you see. And it was getting us back into fitness shape, route marches and things of that nature. And of course, there was always a fair bit of sport I was involved. We were mainly though they played all sorts of games of sport, but we were mainly rugby league football. Then there was work done to make the camp more comfortable, and of course then there's the officer's mess had to be built, and orderly rooms and all those sorts of things, which you'd be on working parties or something of that nature, and then working parties for supplies and things, so that everybody was occupied sort of business. Then the grog situation was you got a ration, I think one or two bottles a week or fortnight or something like that. But there was one occasion, I don't know whether it was at that time in Atherton, or the next time that there's a big shindig on for the powers to be with the AGH nursing sisters and the like were invited to this big shindig, and unfortunately the liquor didn't supply us, didn't turn up, but the troops got theirs, so somehow or other they were transferred across to satisfy the big shindig, because I think there's brigadiers and all anyway, the way it went this evening, and all of a sudden there was some smoke, and a bit later on the thatch roof was on fire, and apparently that was the end of that evening.
As I understand, it was split up into various divisions. What did that involve? The division was split.
Yeah, I'm just a bit hesitant here. What happened was, when we changed from desert establishment to a jungle establishment, they cut it down, supporting troops, they cut it down to just take them there in the artillery side. You had three regiments, field regiments, to the division, and one anti-aircraft, one anti-tank. So when they came into the jungle one, they had to cut the 20,000 personnel down to whatever, I can't remember what number it was. It was quite considerable, so much so that taken out situation, one battery was put to the 7th Division, that was a 10 battery, 11 battery went to 9, another one went to the 6th Division, and that's one was spare, so that one was disbanded, and I'm not too sure when that actually happened. In 43 or 44, but that's what eventually happened.
By the time you'd done your training, how confident did you feel that you would be able to?
Well, we were quite happy about, you know, the use of our weapons and things like that, but we just have to acclimatise the situation to how, when, and why we do it. Things wasn't laid down in any sort of pattern, because you're in the jungle and you don't know what's going to happen next round the corner. But that's more in the infantry line, because we'd be following up behind infantry if it was necessary in the jungle. And We did have, or we were trying to become secondary or support infantry if the case was required of us. So that was the build up, and I mean the majority of officers and that were sent to the appropriate schools associated, NCOs also, and of course they came back and it went down the line sort of business. But because it was that time that the ho-ho started. I'm not too sure who originated it, but what would happen if you were like, on one occasion we got off the train and it was dark and there was no transport for us to go to our particular staging camp, so we had to carry all our own gear and that. And somebody started off this ho-ho business, and there might be 200 or 300 fellas marching along or strolling along, and they started with this ho-ho business, and then somebody would start directing sheepdogs and things like that, farmers of it. It was quite a humorous situation. You could imagine this in the middle of the night,